The book of Revelation is the Lord's last message to His church. In chapter 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ does not mean the revelation about Christ. It's the revelation by Christ. It's the last book in the Bible. It's the cap sheaf on the Bible. And perhaps ideally it should be studied after everything else in the Bible. But there aren't a lot of things in life that we approach in an ideal way. And we welcome each one of you to our study of the book of Revelation. We're glad you're here, whether you've studied the rest of the Bible or not. Happy to have you with whatever background you happen to have. The book of Revelation is a book of prophecy. Before prophets were called prophets, they were called seers. 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9. A seer was one who could see things that other people could not see. One to whom God gave special enlightenment. The book of Revelation contains one connected vision seen by John on one Lord's Day. A prophet is one who speaks under divine impulse. When the prophets were speaking or writing under inspiration, they didn't always know what they were talking about. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10 through 12 says that the prophets were searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when He testified beforehand the suffering of Christ and the glory that should follow. They didn't know what they were talking about sometimes, but God was giving a message through them. I believe that you and I today are in a better position to understand the book of Revelation than the man who wrote it was. There's no reason to believe that John understood this book any more than we should believe that Isaiah understood his messianic predictions. We understand the book of Isaiah far better than Isaiah did. The job of these prophets was not to understand what they were writing. The job of these prophets was to accurately convey what was given to them to convey. Now, I don't know how you feel as you think about the book of Revelation and as we approach it in this class. Some people I know approach it with a sense of trepidation. Oh, that's just too deep for me. I hope you won't feel that way about it. The book of Revelation is intended to be understood. The word apocalypsis, from which we translate revelation, means an uncovering, a laying bare, an unveiling, a making naked, a disclosure. It refers to something that used to be hidden and now has become visible. It means to expose to view that which previously has been hidden. It's a revelation, not a mystery. Though it is written in symbolic language, it's not a sealed book anymore. The seals have been loosed now. The covering is rolled off so that the future can be seen. We're intended to understand this book, and we each can have a general understanding of it if we want it. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable, and that includes the book of Revelation. There are some of you in this class who may be looking at it for the very first time. Anything you approach for the first time may cause apprehension. You can remember the first time you drove a car. I had an aunt who drove a car for the first time and had a wreck her very first time, and she never did learn to drive after that. Too shy of it after that. But most of us now drive with no problem at all, even though we had qualms at first. The more familiar you make yourself with anything, the easier it becomes. I don't blame you if you feel unsure about some things in Revelation. All of us feel unsure about some things that are in this book. But I hope you won't let that stop you from digging into this. There are people in this class who have studied the book of Revelation many, many times. Some of you have taught it many times. There are definite differences within our class in levels of familiarity with the material. We are not going to be able to read all of it or even most of it in the class. If you're not familiar with the book, I think you can help yourself a lot before tomorrow if you just read the book before tomorrow. Most of you can do that within an hour, under an hour. And we'll try to stay together that way as a class. Now, my assignment is a survey of Revelation rather than a full study of it. There are some parts of it that we won't be dealing with at all. But the core of the book is what I'd like to look at in whatever detail we can manage. There are building blocks involved in the study of the book of Revelation. Later materials build on earlier material. It's a bit like mathematics in that way. We need the basics in order to continue. We need to stay together as a class as much as we possibly can and understand as we go along. The book of Revelation was written by the Apostle John, the last surviving apostle, about 96 AD. Irenaeus in the 2nd century said that the apocalyptic vision was seen not very long since, but almost in our day, toward the end of Domitian's reign. The reign of Domitian was from 81 to 96 AD. Irenaeus himself may have been born as early as 115 AD. And so he says it was almost in our time. And he was identifying the time when this book was written. Now, there are people, as you probably know, who date the revelation during Nero's reign from 54 to 68. The arguments for this I find very unconvincing. I believe they conflict with the belief of the early church. Irenaeus said it was written toward the end of Domitian's reign. Clement of Alexandria said the same thing. Origen, Victorinus, who wrote one of the very earliest commentaries on the book of Revelation, Eusebius, Jerome, they all affirm this Domitian date. The spiritual decline of the seven churches that had occurred also argues for the later date. Those seven churches were strong and spiritually healthy in the mid-60s when Paul was in Asia Minor. The brief time between Paul's work there and the end of Nero's reign was way too short for such a decline to have occurred as we see in the second and third chapters of the book of Revelation. The longer gap in time also allows for the rise of the Nicolaitans, who are not even mentioned in Paul's letters, not even in the one he wrote to Ephesus. You would have thought that if he wrote this close in time to Revelation 2, that he surely would have mentioned the Nicolaitans. We have four New Testament letters written to or concerning the church at Ephesus: Ephesians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and the letter dictated by the Lord to the Ephesian church in Revelation 2. And you can just tell that the one in Revelation 2 was written considerably later than the others by the things that are said. Trials of apostles, people that said they were apostles and weren't. This was written a generation later. Dating from the time of Nero's reign does not allow for John's work in Asia Minor to have reached the point where the authorities would have felt the need to exile him. There had to be some time go by for this to occur. Domitian was the second great persecutor of the church among the Roman emperors. Nero was the first, but Nero confined his persecution primarily to the city of Rome. Domitian was the first to punish Christians for their refusal to worship the emperor as a god. The disciple whom Jesus loved was apparently boiled in oil. All his skin came off, but he didn't die. And then he was exiled to this rocky island of Patmos, about 60 miles southwest of Ephesus, one of thousands of islands out in the Aegean Sea. This island was used as a penal colony. Victorinus reports that John was consigned in his old age to slave labor in the mines. So that may or may not be true, but however that may be, he was on Patmos when he received the vision in the book of Revelation. And until 150 years after the Apostle John, nobody doubted that it was he who wrote the book of Revelation. And unless somebody here doubts it, then I don't think we need to look at any other ideas. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass." We're going to look at the book of Revelation from a historical point of view. This is the oldest method of understanding the book. And the longer I live, the more I am convinced that it is the correct view of the book. It's far more satisfying than any other view I've ever encountered. The Old Testament prophecies had historical fulfillments. Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelion, "It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." This had a historical fulfillment in events that occurred. The dreams of Joseph, the dreams of the Pharaoh, the dreams of the butler and the baker, all of these were fulfilled, and they were all fulfilled by events. The New Testament prophecies have historical fulfillments as well. They are fulfilled by events. The things which must shortly come to pass are events. And they didn't all happen at once. The Greek inflection here is what must begin to soon occur. That which is about to start to occur after this. That they must soon begin to come to pass. That's the idea here. We see the same kind of expression in the third chapter to Laodicea. "I am about to spit you out of my mouth." It's not only future, but it is impending. He says in chapter 1, verse 3, "The time is at hand." And again at the end of the book, in chapter 22, verse 6, "These sayings are faithful and true, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show unto his servants the things which must shortly be done." And again in verse 10 of the last chapter, he saith unto me, seal not the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. What time? The time for these prophecies to begin to be fulfilled. The focus is on the quickness and the nearness in these verses. It's on the beginning of the fulfillment, not on the consummation of the fulfillment, which still hasn't occurred. But it's the nearness and the quickness is on the beginning of the fulfillment. These prophecies were soon to begin to become history. God couldn't wait any longer to give this vision if it was still all going to be prophecy. The time was at hand. The fulfillment would begin very soon. The Apostle John was told in chapter 1, verse 19, to write down three things. First of all, write the things which thou hast seen. Now, that's the material we have in chapter 1. Then write the things which are. That's the material we have in chapters 2 and 3. The circumstances of the seven churches in 96 AD. And then finally, the things which shall be hereafter. These things are introduced in chapter 4, verse 1. After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard speaking unto me like a trumpet said, come up hither, come up here, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. The hereafter things go all the way then to the end of the book. So this is an outline of the book in chapter 1, verse 19. Some of the things at the end of the book haven't even been fulfilled yet, but most of the things in the book have been fulfilled. Then in chapter 5, verse 1, John saw a scroll in the right hand of God. He saw a scroll that was written on both sides and sealed with seven seals. In chapter 6, verse 1, the Lamb opens the first seal on that scroll and away we go. The prophecy, most of which is now history, begins to unroll in a panoramic picture from John's day to the judgment day and beyond. Why? Because the book of Revelation is a book of comfort and support for the people of God. It was written to saints in dire distress who were persecuted by a cruel empire. Saints who could have despaired of life itself. When the Apostle Paul one time despaired of life, the Lord stood beside him at night and showed him some of his future. He was told, Paul, rather than dying in your present distress, thou shalt also bear witness unto me in Rome. And Paul was buoyed up by this, buoyed up by the possibilities and the victory that was going to come in his future. The book of Revelation was written for a similar purpose. It was written to indicate the general course of future events, to make the saints wise before these things occurred, and to turn any pessimism into optimism, because it showed that they were going to be victorious in the end. You know, great events are commonly judged quite wrongly by the people who live through them. So here, the prescient Spirit of God makes known to Christ's servants everything they need to know about their future. Not everything they want to know about it. The Bible gives us enough to satisfy our needs, but never nearly enough to satisfy our curiosity. But He gave them here everything they needed to know about their future. And perhaps the key verse of the book of Revelation is chapter 17, verse 14. Of the persecutors we are told that these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with Him are called and chosen and faithful. Here is assurance that no matter how dark things look at any given time, the Lord and His people will ultimately prevail. The Lord wanted to inoculate persecuted Christians against despair by convincing them that by and by, eventually, in the end, sooner or later, victory would be theirs. As long as we stick with Him, we'll be right where we need to be. As we read this book, it becomes apparent that a greater than John is here. One who sees the end from the beginning. One who calls the things which be not as though they were. During the 15th century, since John wrote this book, in the first 15 centuries after John wrote this book, it was commonly viewed as a forecast of the progress and the destiny of the church in her interaction with the world, from the time of the New Testament to the end time consummation. Now much of the prophecy has already been fulfilled. Revelation addresses the primary concern of the persecuted church at the end of the first century when it was written. The destiny of the church under that terrible Roman beast of Daniel chapter 7, including the rise of the little horn that came out of that beast in Daniel 7. Now, this is what we call the historicist interpretation, which I still believe and still teach. This was believed by nearly all Protestant interpretations during the Reformation and for centuries afterward. It was believed by pre-Reformation dissidents from Romanism, people who were in the Lord's Church, I believe, the same as you and I. But at some point, the historicist view becomes pretty rough on the apostate church. And maybe that's why a couple of Jesuit scholars, as a part of the Counter-Reformation, developed and published two alternative ways of reading these prophecies. The Jesuits were founded in 1540 by Ignatius Loyola to be totally supportive of the Pope. And the Jesuit priest Alcazar, who died in 1613, took the view that these prophecies had already been fulfilled in divine judgments against the Jews and against the old Roman Empire. This approach developed into the interpretation that is known today as preterism. Preterism comes from a Latin expression meaning gone by, that these things are long gone by. Preterism says that the book of Revelation was fulfilled early. Some would say even as early as 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem. I've met people who think the entire book of Revelation is all about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Some think it was fulfilled by 325, the Council of Nicaea in the days of Constantine. Some people think it went as late as 476 AD with the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Many Church of Christ preachers in our time are advocates of preterist views. Names that might be recognizable to many of you have published commentaries along these lines. Foy Wallace, Jim McGuigan, Homer Haley all took a preterist approach to the book of Revelation. And they say these are things which must shortly come to pass. You can't still have them going on. They had to be fulfilled a long time ago because they were shortly going to come to pass. Well, what makes you think 300 years is short if you go to the Council of Nicaea? These were shortly to begin to come to pass, and I believe they started to be fulfilled within a year of the time that John wrote these things down. But they couldn't all happen at once. How can all things happen at once? Now, there was another Jesuit priest by the name of Ribera, who took the opposite approach. He published his commentary in 1590, and he advocated that all the prophecies in Revelation after the seal judgments relate to the last few years at the end of time, when a future Antichrist will come and wage war against the saints. And with some modifications, this has become known as the futurist view. The preterist and futurist views became popular in Roman Catholic circles and remain so. The left behind futurist view, the idea that chapters 4 through 22 are still future, is very popular in our country at this time, as I think most of you know. Many people who believe the futurist view in our time aren't even aware that there is any other view of the book of Revelation. The idea that Revelation deals with events just before the consummation of all things. That's the futurist view. And it has the advantage of putting these prophecies into the unknown future where they can't be falsified yet, rather than trying to look in the history of the church about them. In the late 19th century and the 20th century, it was popularized in the United States by the Moody Bible Institute and the Scofield Bible and the institutions that grew out of those spheres of influence, so that today the futurist view, when you go out and talk, I mean, if we were to go up and down these streets and talk to the people in these homes, the futurist view would be overwhelmingly believed among people who had any view at all of the book of Revelation. Not only does the modern futurist view show an excessive literalism that seems inappropriate to understanding apocalyptic language, it also has a church age parenthesis in between the 69th and 70th weeks of Daniel chapter 9. A parenthesis between them for which there is no biblical basis whatsoever. I only know of one scholar prior to the late 19th century who excluded the so-called church age from the prophecies of Revelation. His name was Hippolytus, and he died in 236 AD. He assumed that there was a gap between the 69th and 70th weeks of Daniel 9:24. His commentary on Revelation has not been preserved. But according to the modern theory, we've been in this supposed parenthesis now for about 2,000 years. But in Daniel chapter 9, the 70 weeks, well, it's divided into the first 7 weeks and then the next 62 weeks and the final week, and nothing is assigned to that 62 weeks. The only function of that 62 weeks is to indicate the span between the first 7 weeks and the 70th week. In other words, the 70th week is connected to the 62. It's not separated by an unmentioned and undefined period of time, as so many say today. The modern idea about this parenthesis reminds me of the guy who said, well, I quit smoking for 15 days, but not in a row. Well, he didn't really quit smoking for 15 days. 7 plus 62 plus 1 equals 70. 7 plus 62 plus x plus 1 does not equal 70. It equals 70 plus x, an indeterminate period of time. Contrary to the text in Daniel 9, which says, quote, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. The modern futurist parenthetical church age view seems to say that Jesus failed to establish his kingdom at his first coming. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. And this was a surprise to God, who then had to institute the church age as a stopgap until the Lord could come back and rule as he had planned to do the first time. According to this view, the church was never predicted in the Old Testament because it's just an afterthought of God. It's just a band-aid solution. The Lord said the things predicted must soon begin to occur, shortly come to pass. The time is at hand. The futurist view leaves the book of Revelation completely out of relation to the needs of the churches to which it was originally addressed. I believe the fulfillment of Revelation began within a year, maybe just a lot shorter than that, of the time that it was written. But obviously it couldn't all happen at once. But the process of fulfillment began right away. Anyway, preterism and futurism largely replaced the historical interpretation in the minds of many people in the later 19th and in the 20th century. Preterism in the mainline denominations and futurism in most evangelical type churches. There's one more view that I should mention here, and that is sometimes called the spiritual view or the idealist view or a philosophy of history view, which expounds the book of Revelation not as a prediction of events, but rather as teaching principles regarding good and evil applicable in every age. Maybe the most popular representative of this is William Hendrickson with his book, More Than Conquerors. A more recent commentary along the same lines is that of G.K. Beale, who was very thorough on this issue. These works, More Than Conquerors and G.K. Beale's work, they're transtemporal type works. In other words, they avoid the necessity of correlating the predictions with specific historical fulfillments. This view sees the book as a timeless depiction of the cosmic struggle between good and evil. Ancient documents like the Bible should be understood as the original recipients in their cultural and historical situation should have understood them. One of the charges most commonly made against the historicist view is that a prophecy which was going to have its fulfillment throughout the course of all history would have little or no meaning to the first century churches for whom it was originally written. But on that premise, nearly all the prophecies of Scripture would have been meaningless to the original recipients. Let me talk about meaning here just for a second, because this sometimes comes up. The meaning is in the text itself. Not only in the question of when and how a prediction is fulfilled. Meaning for the recipients of an unfulfilled prophecy has two distinct aspects. Number one, what is predicted, but also, given the prediction, how should I live? Given the prediction, how should I respond in practical, everyday Christian life? What I'm saying to you is the fact that the second aspect here is transtemporal, in other words, transcending time, in other words, applicable to all time, does not eradicate the temporal implications of the first when we answer what is predicted. My understanding of the dream vision apocalyptic of Revelation is based largely on the visions of Daniel. Several of Daniel's visions come to us with interpretation. In fact, almost all of them do. In the book of Daniel, I don't have the option of concluding that their predictions are primarily transtemporal. The predictions in Daniel clearly forecast future temporal events in symbolic language. At its core, the book of Revelation is just an expanded commentary on the prophecies of Daniel, especially the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel. So it seems to me that those who de-emphasize or deny the predictive element in the book of Revelation have to turn away from the words of Jesus. Jesus said that this was to show what must soon take place. And to show what must soon take place is to disclose future events. One more thing about these differing views of the book of Revelation. Within all of these schools that we've talked about, there are numerous differences of interpretation. And most of you know that the core of the book of Revelation is the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls of wrath. Within each school, there are some who treat the relationship between the seals and the trumpets and the bowls as parallel. Parallel, in other words, one series would be parallel to the series that comes after it and the series that comes after that. They believe that we go through history in each series. So therefore, the first seal is parallel to the first trumpet, and that's parallel to the first bowl, and so on. The second seal would be parallel to the second trumpet, which would be parallel to the second bowl. And in this matter, going through history at least three times in the book, some would say you go through history four times. Some I've even heard go through history seven times in the book of Revelation. On the other hand, there are those who treat this as continuous. In other words, chronologically and consecutively from the seals to the trumpets to the bowls, consecutively flowing naturally in a linear series, perhaps with occasional proleptic scenes of celebration inserted at crisis points where future events are presented as if present in order to encourage the church as it anticipates suffering. So we have, just like they used to have in Greek drama that was written at this time, we have cycles of action and interlude, as exactly as in an ancient play. I believe that the book of Revelation has a continuous historical structure, with the seventh seal introducing the trumpets, which chronologically come after the seals, and the seventh trumpet introducing the bowls, which chronologically come after the trumpets. There are reasons why I believe that. One is what we find in the book of Daniel. The book of Revelation picks up the dominant themes and the style of the visions that we find in the book of Daniel. It seems to be intended to be read as the same kind of literature that we have in the book of Daniel. The book of Revelation is just an expansion of the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel contains five or six apocalyptic style prophecies, depending on whether or not you include Daniel 4 about Nebuchadnezzar. But either way, each of these visions was received on a particular occasion and was received independently of the others. Each of the visions in Daniel, except the last, is accompanied by a divinely given interpretation. The last one is sealed until the time of the end. Each vision in Daniel is continuous in structure within the vision itself, predicting a consecutive series of conditions or events. The book of Revelation contains one vision received by John on one Lord's Day, one occasion. Also, in addition to the book of Daniel, there are literally hundreds of other apocalyptic visions that were being read by Jews and Christians in the first century, and these forecast continuously consecutive events or conditions. The readers would have been conditioned by their familiarity with this genre to read the structure of the book of Revelation continuously. There's no precedent for parallel structure within a vision in the hundreds of extant apocalyptic works that existed at the time that the Revelation was written. To me, therefore, it seems that the burden of proof would rest on those who would read it differently from the way all these apocalyptic visions were to be read, and from all these things that were so similar, as if the book of Revelation were a unique genre standing alone by itself, and it's parallel, but everything else that you find is continuous. There's another thing here, too. The literary character of these three sequences, the seals and the trumpets and the bowls, lends itself naturally to a consecutive understanding. The internal indicators imply, if they don't just flatly state, that a chronological sequence is intended. Let me give you a couple examples of this. One of them, in the fifth seal, the martyrs are advised to wait until the number of their fellow servants who were to be killed has been completed, chapter 6, verse 11. And yet there's no subsequent martyrdom predicted in the seal series. The later martyrs come after the seal series. If the seal series runs clear through time, then where are the later martyrs? Another example, we see the marking of God's covenant people under the sixth seal in chapter 7, and reference is made to this subsequently in the second series under the fifth trumpet. So we see it under the sixth seal, but then we have a reference back to these people in the fifth trumpet. In the parallel view, what happens under the sixth seal should not happen until under the sixth trumpet. Another example here to try to clarify this. In the sixth seal, the future martyrs were still to be slain. But in the third bowl in chapter 16, they have already been slain and judgment is already being executed on their murderers. If the parallel view were true, then what happens under the fifth seal shouldn't happen until the fifth bowl. So you can see that I'm not a fan of the parallel view. I just don't think it works at all. Another thing here, when we look at the end of each one of these series, The sixth seal seems to be the last seal that discloses earthly events. And that seems to be true of the trumpet series as well. The sixth trumpet is the last trumpet to disclose earthly events. The seventh seal and the seventh trumpet do not contain significant prediction, but rather serve to introduce the next series of seven. But the seventh bowl at the end of chapter 16 adds a seventh prediction. This may be a clue for understanding the chronological relationship between the seal and trumpet and bowl judgments. If the parallel reading were intended, we would expect the culminating judgment of the seventh bowl would have a strong correlation in the seventh seal and the seventh trumpet, with some indicators that the chronological clock was being turned back so we could start all over through history again. But we don't find that. We have also an indicator of the continuous structure of the book of Revelation in the series of the three woes. And these are very interesting. The three woes are identified as the last three trumpet blasts in chapter 8, verse 13. The endings of the first and second woes are clearly labeled in chapter 9, verse 12, and in chapter 11, verse 14. It seems to me that only the continuous chronology can account for the isolated location of the notice in chapter 11, verse 14, for the second woe. And the third woe, announced by the seventh trumpet, has to be one of two things. It either has to be the descent of Satan in chapter 12, or it has to be the seven bowls, which chapter 15 tells us are the seven last plagues. For in them the wrath of God is completed. Chapter 15, verse 1. Only the bowl series, I think, really fills the requirements of the third woe. That is, it is the last. And the word last indicates a chronology of events. If the bowls are parallel to the seals and the trumpets, then in what sense are the bowls the last? And yet, we're clearly told that they are the last. The difficulty of a construction which places the third woe somewhere in parallel with the first two is obvious. A natural reading of the text results, I believe, in a continuous understanding of the seals, and then the trumpets, and then the bowls in an event-oriented sequence. The book of Revelation is the Lord's last message to the church, and it promises a special blessing to those who read it, and to those who hear it, and those who take it to heart and keep it. This is in chapter 1, verse 3. It's the only book in the Bible that makes this specific promise about those who read it and hear it and keep it. There's a lot in the book of Revelation for practical application to daily life. It concludes with a warning of judgment on anyone who adds to it or takes away from the prophecies of it in chapter 22, verses 18 and 19. So as we study it together and think about it, we hear ideas batted back and forth, prove all things and hold fast that which is good, 1 Thessalonians 5:21. There are four things that I believe help us to understand the book of Revelation. One is a general knowledge of the Bible. A lot of people, when you convert them, they want to study the book of Revelation first. Many times you have a young people's class and they want to study the book of Revelation first. Well, that's all right. I'm glad somebody wants to study any part of the Bible. But if we were doing it in an ideal way, we would study everything else in the Bible first and then get to the book of Revelation. So we need a general knowledge of the Bible under our belt, ideally, to do our thinking about this book. Also, we need a knowledge of history. Here is a place in the Bible where you can't take only the Bible and understand it completely. You need to understand what it was referring to, so you read it with the Bible in one hand and a history book in the other hand. Also, we need a special knowledge of the Old Testament prophets, and in particular, the prophecies of Daniel, the prophecies of Ezekiel, a few prophecies from Zechariah, and some others as well. Special knowledge of the Old Testament prophets is very, very helpful, and a knowledge of Bible symbols as well. The sun, moon, and stars in prophecy in the first book of the Bible mean the same thing as they do in the last book of the Bible. When Joseph had his dream about the sun, moon, and stars, these had the same basic meaning in Genesis that they do in the book of Revelation. God is not changing His signals like we would do in a baseball game that's being televised, the World Series, and there's a runner on second, or there's a center field camera, and so they change their signals to confuse the opposing team who's definitely watching TV in the dugout. God's not changing His signals because God's not playing games. He's not trying to confuse us. He wants us to understand this. In the earliest days of the church, it's important to understand that apocalyptic writings were common, and the symbols, for the most part, were understood. This type of literature was much more frequently known and understood and could be taken just in pace by the people who read it in the first place than perhaps we who read it today. There were, as I said earlier, several hundred apocalyptic books that were written from the 2nd century or even late 3rd century B.C. through at least the 1st century A.D. And the symbols in all of these, including the book of Revelation, are drawn primarily from the reservoir of symbolic language in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is, for the most part, the place where we learn the meaning of the symbols. We might ask, why would God use symbols to present His message? Why didn't He just plainly say what He wanted to say? Wouldn't that have been a lot simpler? In the first place, apocalyptic language often predicted the downfall of governments, and that's true here in this book. Had this been written in plain language, and a Christian who was advocating it got caught with it, that they could have been charged with subversion of the ruling authorities. Additionally, it was written to conceal the meaning from all but the dedicated. The Lord spoke in parables for the same reason, and He said so in places like the 13th chapter of the book of Matthew. Now, the Lord interpreted some of His parables for His apostles, that His apostles might thereby learn to interpret the other parables that the Lord had not interpreted for them. He gave them enough so that they could learn to interpret. Similarly, in the book of Revelation, He interprets some of the symbols for us. In chapter 1, verse 20, the seven stars are the messengers of the seven churches. Well, if the stars are symbols of people, that puts us on the track to believe that other heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, meteors flashing across the sky, maybe these are symbols of people too. The seven lampstands which thou sawest are the seven churches. Well, if one piece of tabernacle or temple furniture is a symbol, then that leads us to think that maybe the ark and the altars and the courts and the temple itself are symbols too. The writer of the Hebrew letter taught us that the furniture of the tabernacle, these things were shadows of the heavenly things. You know what? George Washington Carver, the guy who discovered over 100 uses for the peanut, said, "Anything will give up its secrets if you love it enough." He said, "Not only have I found that when I talk to the little flower or the little peanut, that they will give up their secrets, but I have found that when I silently commune with people, they give up their secrets also if you love them enough." These symbols have secrets to share with us. With the vagueness of symbolism, the persecutors would not know the meaning. Like the statement of Jesus, "I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me." That was not understood until after it had happened. Now it's easy to see. Hanging on the cross, suspended between heaven and earth, as we say, He was lifted up. But they didn't know what that meant when He originally said it, that He was going to be like the brazen serpent in the wilderness. Why symbols? Another possibility is the oriental beauty that's involved here in the symbolism. Each symbol has its own specific significance, like hieroglyphics. We understand it the way we came to understand the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone has hieroglyphics, it has common Egyptian, and it has Greek. Champollion loved it enough to decipher it. It's quite a study of how he went about doing that. It's a fascinating story. He sacrificed a great deal to decipher the hieroglyphics, but he did accomplish that. Why symbols? Scripture usually veils such prophecies, and the ambiguity is enhanced by the symbols. Trying to understand can sometimes be frustrating. Martin Luther is supposed to have thrown a copy of the book of Revelation into the Elbe River because he said, "I just can't understand it. How can it be a revelation?" But he was living a part of the fulfillment during his lifetime. We're more equipped now to understand it than he was in his day. It seems that the divine author designed this book to prevent people from knowing the future too accurately, while at the same time ensuring an attitude of watchfulness in preparation for the great events to come. The meaning could not be fully understood until after the fulfillment. Prior to the fulfillment, we saw through a glass darkly. Now, it is true that certain students of the book of Revelation were able to predict some things from it, rather remarkably so at times. Joseph Meade anticipated some of the events described by the vials 150 years ahead of time, predicting things that didn't look at all likely when he wrote in the 17th century. Peter Giraud, in the 1687 English translation of his work, predicted that France would have a revolution about 1785 and a separation from the papacy would follow. Robert Fleming in 1701 predicted from the fifth vial that the judgment poured out on the seat of the beast would begin about 1794 and continue to about 1848. Certainly, prognostication is sometimes possible. We can study unfulfilled portions of the text and get a sense of what the future holds. But the meaning can be fully understood only after the fulfillment. And brethren, this is the genius of God. This is the genius of God. He encrypted His message in symbolic language so that each generation has a sense of the challenge of what is to come, but still lives in the hope of the Lord's imminent return. If the Lord had spelled it all out in plain language for the seven churches of Asia about how time was going to stretch out beyond them, there's no way they could have believed that the Lord might return during their lifetime. But they lived in the belief that He might return then, just as we live in the same hope now. The book of Revelation hasn't changed in two millennia, but it is progressively clarified by events over time. Just as on Patmos it was unrolled to John, seal by seal, trumpet to trumpet, bowl by bowl, on one Lord's Day. Hey, by the way, the word Lord's Day is found in contemporaneous writings referring to Sunday, the first day of the week. Don't ever let a Seventh-day Adventist tell you otherwise. As time rolls on, we are in a position to understand the book of Revelation better. The 10th century could not see what we can see. Martin Luther could not see what we can see. We can look at the book and discern our own times. I do not know what was written on that seven-sealed scroll. It may be that the actual history was written there. I mean with names and dates and all the details. That's perfectly possible that was all written on that seven-sealed scroll. John does not tell us that he saw what was written on the scroll. He saw that there was writing on it, but it does not tell us that he was close enough to see what the writing was, and beside it was still sealed up when he saw that it was written on both sides. He does not tell us that he read the scroll. Rather, as the scrolls were loosed, he was told to write down what he saw and what he heard. He was not told to make a copy of the scroll. As the seals were loosed, John saw dramatic tableaus or tableaus. He saw depictions or displays of what corresponded to the things that were written on the scroll. He saw symbolic visions and heard symbolic language about what was written on the scroll at that point, representing in divine hieroglyphics the events recorded on the open portion of the scroll. So John didn't read the book, he saw the movie. And I think this is a very important point. You go to a theater of the round like they have in Disneyland or Disney World or Worlds of Fun, where people vomit on the floor because they think they're in a plane going over the Alps when they're really just standing there. But they have these screens all around and they get motion sickness as anybody could, because you feel like you're a part of the action, and in fact you really are in places like that. This is the way I think it was for the Apostle John. I can imagine him ducking down when he sees a horse come riding out. And we know that he wept much when he was seeing this in the fifth chapter because he was involved in the action. But he didn't actually read this scroll itself. At least we're not given any indication that he did. He saw the movie that God gave him to see from it. Now, I'm sure, I don't know whether he just wrote this one copy for all the seven churches and they circulated it, or if he made a copy for each one. But at any rate, I'm sure copies were made very soon after that. Daniel focuses on four beasts representing four world empires. Revelation focuses on the fourth beast, picking up the process of the four Gentile world powers at the point contemporary with the Apostle John. Christians facing persecution at the end of the first century knew that ongoing desolations were predicted for the covenant people of God at the hands of the fourth beast. And they knew that power to be Rome. Why? Because they could count to four? They understood that they could count to four. Here's the seventh chapter of Daniel, 1, 2, 3, 4. Here's history, 1, 2, 3, 4. They knew that Babylon, And Medo-Persia and Greece had already passed from power, and that the fourth beast was Rome, and that they were living under its universal sway. There was no question about this. The Old Testament unfolded the history of the Babylonian and Medo-Persian and Macedonian empires, and it was left to the New Testament book of prophecy, the book of Revelation, to develop the story of the fourth beast. Surely the Lord will do nothing, but he revealeth his secrets unto his servants the prophets. Amos chapter 3, verse 7. Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world. Acts chapter 15, verse 18. He knows it all, backwards and forwards. He doesn't give us history just for the sake of giving us history. He's interested in the history of what affects his people, and that's where he focuses. Chapter 1 is the introduction to the book, but the vision as a whole actually begins in chapter 1, verse 10. When John was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, he heard a voice behind him saying, I am Alpha and Omega. A to Z. And Jesus is all the way from A to Z. He's the advocate, he's the bread, he's the Christ, the door, and you can go clear through the alphabet. In him all things consist. Colossians 1, 16 and 17. The 26 letters in our alphabet, arranged in almost endless combinations, can hold and convey all the knowledge available to us. Jesus Christ is the supreme sovereign alphabet. There's nothing outside of his knowledge. His eyes here are seen to be as blazing fire, a penetrating look deriving from superior intelligence and wisdom. John fell prostrate in abject humility before him. From ground level, John heard the Lord say, I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. The resurrection of Christ is the central evidence of the genuineness and authenticity of the Christian faith. Jesus, in his post-resurrection glorified state, as the author of this testimony, exercises his prophetic role. As the one who walks among the lampstands, serving the churches, he exercises his priestly role. As the ruler of the kings of the earth, he exercises his kingly role, so that he is the anointed prophet, the anointed priest, and the anointed king. Combining all these roles in his one person. No book in Scripture displays this better than the book of Revelation. This anointed Messiah says, I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, and what thou seest, write in a book. The several occasions throughout the book when John is instructed to write or to not write indicate that the writing was done concurrently as the vision progressed. From the standpoint of John's experience, this vision continues on to the end in one connected whole, where Jesus finally finishes in chapter 22, verse 20, and then John says, Even so come, Lord Jesus. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. Amen. And the Bible is completed at that point. The things that John sees and hears and experiences in the vision fill almost the entire book of Revelation. Now, what I propose to do in this survey is just to skip the first five chapters and get right to the core of the book, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. We may leave off the last two chapters also, we probably will, and just also skip other intermittent portions depending on time, because I want our survey to cover the core of the book. So that's why I intend to look at portions of the whole book. I don't want this to be one of those classes where we say, well, he only got to chapter 9. That doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to be that way. There's no need for that if I just pay attention to what I'm doing. My assignment is not to cover it all. After this introduction, we will probably focus mainly on 9 chapters. Chapter 6, 8, 9, 11, 12, 13, 16, 17, and 20. Because these are core chapters that should help us be able to survey the book. Chapters 2 and 3 contain the letters dictated by Jesus to the seven churches of Asia. These were real historical letters to real historical churches in real historical cities in 96 AD. The Lord walking among them reminds us that His church is not an abstraction, but it exists in local congregations. Wherever a body of believers functions organically, with Christ as the head, as we have in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, then there the Lord has a lampstand to hold up His light. We should be conscious of the Lord's presence in the functions of the local congregation. These seven churches were on a route that a messenger would naturally follow in visiting these cities. They were the natural centers of communication in their area. 10 years ago, out in Anaheim, in a meeting like this, I was asked to teach those letters. We spent an hour every day of class during that two-week meeting just on chapters 2 and 3. We saw that the letters each follow a set pattern. They have seven things in common. Some of you were there at that time. These are straightforward letters. They contain little that should be interpreted in a mystical or symbolic fashion. There's nothing in the letters that indicates that they are prophecies. The letters precede the things which are shortly to occur, which is introduced in chapter 4, verse 1. They're not written in the symbolic style, which constitutes the bulk of the book. So I take them in the plain sense. They contain messages that are relevant to churches in any age, and they should be expounded as we do the other New Testament epistles. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. You have 10 minutes. Please be back on time. 11 o'clock.